It is a great pleasure to have interviewed some of the greatest thinkers in the world already this year. We get to meet another one on the radio right now in preparation of welcoming Dr. Michio Kaku into New Zealand. Is it your first time, your first visit to New Zealand?
That's right. I've been to Australia a few times, but never in New Zealand. So this is a first for me.
This is going to be fantastic. We can't wait. We can't wait. You're just going to come along and talk to us. Little, your specialist subject: the future of humanity. Now, you're one of the world's greatest thinkers. You're a theoretical physicist. Is that correct?
That's right, just like Stephen Hawking.
Just like that, from the same stable of great thinkers that have bombarded us with amazing revelations over the last couple of decades. It's a great time for science.
Yeah, we try.
It's a great time for science. It's a great time for humanity, or is it? Da, da, da.
I think so. I'm pretty optimistic about the future.
Do you think, I guess you must be if you're going to do a speech called the Future of Humanity. Do we as humans, have we got our heads around the future, do you think? Are we bred with the tools to predict the future, let alone mold it as we want it to eventuate?
Well, I talk about many things in my lecture, specifically the space program. We're going back to the moon. We are going into a new era of space travel. We had one golden era back in the 1960s, and then we gave up. But now we're entering the second golden age of space exploration. Costs are dropping. Billionaires are opening up their pocketbooks and funding these things. A new generation of rockets is being developed right now. People are signing up. Billionaires are signing up right now to go into outer space, and it's a whole new ball game. Instead of astronauts leading the way, now we have billionaires leading the way, like Elon Musk of SpaceX, Jeff Bezos, richest man in the world of Amazon, Mr. Maezawa in Japan. These are billionaires who are bankrolling this new era of space exploration, a new golden age of exploration.
Do they come knocking on your door to ask you questions?
Well, some do, and of course we scientists try to open up our computers and our programs for these scientists and billionaires, because of course they need to know the science. And realize that these are, look at Elon Musk. He was a PhD physics grad student at Stanford University. He knows his physics. He quit after 2 weeks because, of course, he wanted to make money, and then he went on to found PayPal and became a billionaire. And so these are billionaires who know the science. They come out of the computer world, people like Steve Jobs, like Bill Gates, like Jeff Bezos, and they have a dream. Jeff Bezos of Amazon, for example, the richest man in the world, wants to put humanity in outer space. He wants to put heavy industries in orbit so the Earth becomes a garden. The Earth becomes a park, and all the heavy polluting industry goes into outer space. And he's even funded a series of, moon rockets. Amazon is going to have a system of delivering goods and services to the moon, complements of the Blue Origin space program. And so we have new energy, new ideas, and most important, new bucks driving this second era of space exploration.
Do you think humanity has embraced what seems to be this new age of science? And I mean, I guess it's an age of science because of the amount of information we can all tap into, and because of that, everybody's really driven to find out more, and we have access to resources. It's a great time to be somebody delving into the natural world and finding out how it all happens and why it all happened, isn't it?
That's right. You know, the dinosaurs did not have a space program. And that's why they're not here today. They got wiped out 65 million years ago. Now, we do have a space program. And we do have the capabilities of creating an insurance policy that is going to the moon, going to Mars, going into outer space. And Stephen Hawking, my colleague who passed away recently, said that our future lies in outer space. It's a law of physics. It's a law of physics that the Earth will eventually be destroyed. And of course, there's no rush to go to Mars, but we are going to Mars because prices have dropped considerably. You know that movie, The Martian, with Matt Damon that many people saw? That movie cost $100 million, but the Indians put a space probe on Mars, bypassing Mars, for $70 million. So a Hollywood movie about Mars costs more than actually going to Mars. That's how cheap space travel has become.
It's amazing, too, that the science of space and space travel and expanding our location in the universe, I guess, that the science hasn't stopped happening, has it? We're going to keep discovering things every single moment of every single day from now on and learning from our discoveries.
That's right. You know, I feel like a child in a candy store. There are so many discoveries being made every single day. You realize that we have discovered 4,000 planets circling other stars in the universe, that within the Milky Way galaxy, we now know there are several billion Earth-sized planets. This is a dream. When I was a kid, we could only think about going out to Pluto. Now we're talking about extrasolar planets by the billions in our own backyard in the Milky Way galaxy. I mean, this is a great time to be a scientist. We have the Hubble Space Telescope, we have the Kepler, we have TESS, all these telescopes out there expanding the horizon of our universe. And then we have atom smashers like the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland probing the inside of a proton.
Which is expansive and crazy, isn't it? It's just as mind-blowing.
The Large Hadron Collider outside Geneva is so big, you could put the city of Geneva inside the machine. That's how big the machine is.
Wow.
And it hurls protons at up to 14 trillion electron volts. Energy is not seen since the creation of the universe itself. And so we're probing the deepest secrets of the Big Bang, the deepest secrets of nature. So on one hand, we have instruments finding new planets in outer space, maybe a new home in outer space for us. And on the other hand, we're probing the secrets of what's inside the atom and the Big Bang itself.
It's amazing. I spoke to Neil deGrasse Tyson earlier on this year about astronomy as a science, being particular in the sciences, because a lot of these discoveries, as you mentioned, 4,000 planets discovered recently, a lot of that has been done by people who aren't at the very top of the field. It's been done by amateurs who are just passionate and driven to try and find out and contribute to the science. You know, so especially when it comes to seeing things in this massive universe we live in, everybody's like clubbing
That's
together
right.
and sending the information to the people that matter.
Right. If you look at all the amateurs out there who are looking for killer asteroids and killer comets out there, you could put them in a McDonald's restaurant. That's how few there are. There are only about 30 or so amateurs doing the yeoman's work of looking for deadly rocks in space that could eventually hit the Earth. Only recently has NASA and the big telescopes joined in this hunt. But yeah, it was amateurs that paved the way. They were the ones who discovered many of these planets, many of these comets in outer space. And that's why we realized that we really do have to know what's out there. So going to Mars, that's an insurance policy. That's why Elon Musk, for example, one of the richest men in the world, says that we have to be a multi-planet species. I once interviewed Carl Sagan, the astronomer, and he said that we have to be at least a biplanet species. We have to be at least on two planets, because in case something bad happens to one, we have an insurance policy, and that's why the Mars mission is on people's agenda. In fact, the President of the United States last year signed a directive. We go back to the moon starting next year. Then we go to Mars and the asteroids and beyond. So this is a great time to be interested in astronomy and the universe.
You've said in the past that, we are, and I agree with you, that we're an incredibly arrogant and conceited beast, the human being. And, we think that we deserve everything that we can think up. And as a species, do we have it in us to be able to do that, do you think? To be able to get to and become and achieve these things that we're talking about and that we theoretically can do. But do you think we actually do we have the tools inside us in our DNA to be that species that is able to do that?
Yeah, I think so. However, we have our greatest enemy, and our greatest enemy is ourselves.
Yeah.
Because we still have all the impulses of the past, greed and racial differences and wanting to conquer our enemies and create mischief and problems like that. We still have all that. However, the march of science promotes democracy. Think of the Internet. before the internet, it was very difficult for poor people to access the news to find out if their ruler is really a good ruler or not. Now with the internet, people are toppling their rulers because they realize that they're poor. Why should they be poor when other countries are rich? And so the internet spreads democracy. People are beginning to understand the nature of the world situation, and they're doing something about it. And so I think that technology here actually has a moral, ethical direction. It's not neutral. The internet spreads information, which spreads democracy, and democracies do not war with other democracies. Think of every war that you had to memorize since you were a child, every single war. They've always been between kings, queens, dictators, emperors, but never between two major democracies.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm optimistic, because the more we learn about the universe, the more we push the internet out, the more we spread democracy, and democracies do not war with other democracies.
You share that optimism about artificial intelligence as well, I believe.
That's right. Some people are afraid of artificial intelligence. However, you have to realize that for the next several decades, I think Mark Zuckerberg is right. Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook says that artificial intelligence will generate jobs, new industries, prosperity, new economic activity. Now, of course, in the long term, not talking about maybe 100 years, machines could turn on us. And so I think we should put a fail-safe system. We should put a chip in their brain to shut them off if they have murderous thoughts, but that's not going to be for maybe another 100 years. Robots today are pretty stupid. Robots today have the intelligence of a cockroach, a retarded cockroach. So they have a long ways to go before they're going to replace humans. So in the short term, I think we have to embrace artificial intelligence as a source of jobs, prosperity, opportunity. But in the long term, now going on decades into the future, we do have to put a fail-safe system on them, because any technology can eventually turn on you.
When you travel around and meet people from all over the world, you've made some amazing documentaries, presented some amazing TV shows. One of the founders of String Theory, you've got a whole bunch of stuff under your belt that you could quite happily rest on your laurels with. Why travel the world and do performances like you're going to perform for us here in Auckland and Wellington and Christchurch, when you could just quite happily be a well-known scientist that everybody respects? What is it about the imparting of the things you've discovered, or the things that amaze you, that makes it so worthwhile to put in all that extra effort?
Well, it all started when I was 8 years old. When I was 8 years old, everyone talked about the fact that a great scientist had just died, and they put a picture of his desk in all the evening news. And the caption, I still remember, said something like this: "This is the desk of the unfinished work of the greatest scientist of our time." So I said to myself, whoa, wow, he couldn't finish it. What's so hard? What's so hard that the greatest scientist of our time couldn't finish it? Why didn't he ask his mother? It's a homework problem, right? Well, I went to the library, and then later I found out the man's name was Albert Einstein. And that book that he couldn't finish was The Theory of Everything. Stephen Hawking has said that this was the theory that would allow Einstein to, quote, read the mind of God. And I said to myself, whoa, that's for me. I want to work on this great theory. This sounds like fun. And that's what I do for a living. I'm one of the creators of String Theory, which we think is the leading candidate for a theory of everything. And I get excited talking about it, and I get enthusiastic, and I can't help it. I really have to tell people that we are about to make some of the greatest breakthroughs in the history of science. If the theory pans out, it is the theory of everything. A theory that one day, for example, will tell us what's on the other side of a black hole, what happened before creation, are there other dimensions, other universes, is time travel possible? All the kinds of things you see in science fiction cannot be answered using Einstein's theory. Einstein's theory is not powerful enough. In fact, Einstein himself realized that his theory failed at the instant of the Big Bang and the center of a black hole. But that's where this theory comes in. This theory goes beyond Einstein and answers these age-old questions like time travel, like other universes. All these things that you read about and hear about can never be answered until now.
I'm not going to lie to you, Doctor. My heart is fluttering with excitement as you talk about it. Keep going.
So that's the reason why I do it. For me, I can't understand why people are not excited.
Exactly.
By all the breakthroughs that are being made.
Do you feel like sometimes when you're out there doing the public speaking or you're making TV that you should be back at work waiting for, you know, been part of these discoveries, or do you manage to allocate your time perfectly, half and half? You know, because you don't want to miss out. You don't want to be the, like, I can't even imagine what it must have been.
Yeah, one of the regrets, of course, is that there are only 24 hours in a day.
Yeah.
And there are only so many things you can do. So primarily, I'm a research physicist. I work on the unified field theory of Einstein. I can read that book, the book that Einstein couldn't finish. And so we can see all the dead ends that he had. So on one hand, I do research, publishing papers in physics journals and stuff like that. But, you know, every physicist has a hobby. For Einstein, it was playing the violin. For other people, it's like music or skiing or whatever. For me, it's like trying to do television, radio, writing articles, because I want to share the excitement that we feel knowing that we are making breakthrough after breakthrough. You know, when I was a child, we used to wonder, what's beyond Pluto? We used to wonder about whether or not one day we'll be able to travel at supersonic velocities. Things that today are considered trivial, we used to dream about when I was a child, and now we can do it. And so that's what's so exciting, that what was, for me, impossible as a child, children today take for granted. I was talking to a kid the other day about typewriters, and he comes up to me and he says, Professor, what's a typewriter?
Wow. Isn't that amazing?
The kids today don't even know what a typewriter is.
That's a great example of the escalation that I guess comes with a bigger population. Yeah, we live in the information age. Things are turning over a lot quicker, I think, than anybody imagined. Are we going to keep racing forward, doubling pace every couple of years the way we have been? And you talk about 1,000 years in the future or the future of humanity. You know, surely we're just going to get so fast we're going to blow up.
No, it turns out that Moore's law, which says that computer power doubles every 18 months, is slowing down. Believe it or not, this galloping pace that gave us the internet and iPods and iPads and laptops and Apple computers, that tremendous pace of discovery is gradually coming to a close. The end of the age of silicon is near, so we physicists are desperately trying to work on the next generation beyond silicon. What's beyond silicon, we think, are quantum computers, and they're so powerful that we've never been able to successfully build a practical quantum computer. A quantum computer computes on atoms. Individual atoms.
Whoa.
You know, your laptop computes on a layer about 20 atoms across. That's the thinnest layer in your laptop today. In the future, it'll be 5 atoms across. At that point, you get leakage because of uncertainty. You don't know where the electron is, and heat. And your silicon transistor will crash. And that's why we physicists are trying to work on the next generation of computers, and they're called quantum computers. But hey, they don't exist yet. Sorry about that.
I want to maybe move talking to a wee bit about your ideas about extraterrestrials again. It's a bit everybody loves.
Sure.
Everyone loves talking about this. I'm fascinated by it. Have been forever and ever. But my thoughts, I'm much more scientific and analytical in my thinking about it than I used to be. And it is really quite fascinating. I mean, I remember listening to somebody talking about, you know, how we're visited by aliens. If they, as you've said, would even deem to make it point of coming to even visit us for any reason, we breathe oxygen, which is one of the most flammable elements. You know, they might not have anything to do with oxygen. It may destroy them. You know, we don't think about anything too far from the realms of humanity, do we? We've got human-shaped aliens coming in, round metallic objects that shine beams, and that's about it. It's got to be way more freaky than that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I believe in something called laser porting. One day we will digitize most of our behavior and even the human brain. And we'll have, digital immortality. We'll be able to create robots that have our personality and live forever. And we could put that information on a laser beam. Information can be shot at the speed of light on a laser beam to the stars. That means that your consciousness, everything about you, your personality, memories, your feelings, your history, can be put on a laser beam, shot to the moon, and in 1 second, you're on the moon. In 20 minutes, you're on Mars, and in 4 hours, you're on the nearest star without any booster rockets, weightlessness, cosmic rays, radiation, accidents, none of that. A very clean way to explore the universe. I call this laser porting. You know, you don't need flying saucers. You don't need to deal with, you know, flying saucers which crash in Roswell. Forget that. You ride on a light beam, and you've explored the universe at the speed of light. None of this flying saucer business. And let me stick my neck out. I think this may actually already exist. I think aliens in outer space have gotten rid of flying saucers thousands of years ago, and they simply laser port
themselves
across the stars at the speed of light.
They just dropped the hardware, didn't they?
Yeah, maybe they don't even bother with hardware. Maybe they laser port themselves. And there could be a laser highway, a highway of laser beams, maybe near the Earth, with millions of souls laser putting themselves across the universe, and we are too stupid to know it. We're so primitive, we can't even detect the presence of a gigantic superhighway right next to us, carrying millions of souls laser-porting themselves across the universe. And so I think that we have to open our minds to new ways of traveling throughout the universe other than flying saucers.
I spoke to Richard Dawkins about his idea of human beings having a spirit. And, you know, and he was sort of saying that, you know, you can break down the biological components, but there's still that thing in you that desires music and desires to seek out the rush, even if it's a chemical rush, you know, a self-manifesting chemical rush, but there's still something that makes you want to do it, and that we have the spirit. And he says that all living things have it, you know, not so much in a religious way, but we just have it. But I asked him what the thing is with human beings is why we seem to want to share that spirit with each other, because that's something that's, I think, quite unique. If we have something that delights us, we want to tell all the other human beings, hey, this delights us. Does it delight you as well? Is that the consciousness you're talking about transporting? Or is that another angle on it?
First of all, during the Middle Ages, there was something called dualism, where people believed in the spirit or soul and the material body, and the two were separate. Then came a neuroscience of the 20th century, when scientists said, bah, humbug, there's no dualism, there's only neurons, just neurons in the brain. Well, now we're coming full circle. Now we're going back to dualism, because we believe that it may be possible to digitize everything known about you, your credit card transactions, your internet emails, videotapes, pictures, everything that you've ever thought of, everything that you've ever talked about, and the Connectome Project will actually digitize the brain itself. We are mapping the brain in a way that will allow us to perhaps create an artificial brain. Once we can digitize you, for example, instead of going to the library and getting a book about Winston Churchill, you'll talk to Winston Churchill. You'll talk to a holographic image that has all the mannerisms, all the facial features, has complete knowledge of everything that happened to Winston Churchill. I would love to talk to Einstein. I would love to sit down and talk to a holographic image that has all of Einstein's memories, all of his works, and can talk knowledgeably in his voice. I'd love that. And one day, you may be able to talk to your great-great-great-great-great-grandkids because you've become immortal. It's called digital immortality.
It sounds fanciful, doesn't
it? Yeah, it's happening now in Silicon Valley. There's already a company that will digitize everything known about you today. That's just today.
Well, if you think back a couple hundred years ago, the fact that you and I are talking in real time, literally from different sides of the planet, about what we're talking about and how we're recording it and how this will be broadcast out and other people will hear it. Would be complete. You'd take that to the Middle Ages. They would. You'd be drowned. They'd drown you for being a witch.
Yeah,
or something.
People would have thought that would be impossible back then.
Yeah.
And what I'm talking about today is actually well within the laws of physics. It's well within the laws of physics that we'll be able to digitize ourselves and live forever. Now, of course, the question is that really you that has all your memories and talks just like you? Well, it all depends on how you define you. Are you just a biological entity? If so, then we're talking about a sophisticated tape recorder. However, if you is everything known about you, all your memories, all your feelings, everything you've ever done, recorded digitally, if that's you, then that can live forever.
Fascinating. Do you think, just for, it's one more question before you go. I've been fascinated to see ideas that have been written off, have come from, say, New Age speculators and people who come from a more unorthodox, I guess, side of talking about the future and humanity. Seeing those ideas and the ideas from you know, regular science suddenly meet up in the middle and realize, oh no, we're talking about the same thing. Do you know what I mean? There seems to be a lot of as we progress, we said there's a lot of stuff which, you know, be it to do with healing or add the additives to food or resonance or stuff like that. There's just where what used to be considered New Age or sort of you know, fruity thinking have sort of crisscrossed and merged with real honest, good honest, you know, science as we know it, science, and proven that really we were both thinking the same thing.
Well, yeah, if you take a look at religion, for example, and mysticism, scientists usually are repelled by the idea, but actually philosophy permeates all of physics. For example, when I was a child, I realized that my parents were Buddhists, and in Buddhism, there's only nirvana. There's no God, there's no beginning or end. It's just timeless nirvana. But as a child, I was raised as a Presbyterian. So in the Presbyterian Church, there is a beginning when God said, let there be light. Mm-hmm. So how can you reconcile? How can you reconcile this New Age feeling of nirvana and stages of consciousness with the Big Bang Theory, which says, no, there was an instant where God created the universe? Well, in string theory, you can actually meld these two together into one picture. We believe that our universe had a Big Bang. Our universe did have an explosion, but we also realized that these explosions could happen again and again and again. It's something called inflationary theory. So our universe is a bubble of some sort. We live on the skin of the bubble, and the bubble is expanding. It had a beginning. That's called the Big Bang Theory. But in string theory, there are other bubbles out there, other Big Bangs. Other universes being created in a bubble bath of universes called the multiverse. So the multiverse is one of the biggest things in cosmology today. Stephen Hawking, for example, is one of the pioneers of the multiverse theory. And what is the bubble expanding into? It's expanding into nirvana, that is hyperspace, other dimensions predicted by string theory. So here we have a beautiful merging of a Buddhist theory of nirvana with the scientific Christian theory of an origin to the universe. So they can be combined into a single theory called the multiverse.
As long as we don't get too hung up on, which humans do get hung up on the reason for that, why that's happening, then it's actually quite, then just we should just be happy to go along for the ride, shouldn't we, really? Learn what we can learn.
Yeah, And, you know, Galileo was asked all these questions, too, during the Inquisition. And Galileo's answer was very simple. He said the purpose of science is to determine how the heavens go. The purpose of religion is to determine how to go to heaven. So, in other words, science is about natural law, how the universe works. However, religion is about how to go to heaven, that is, ethics. How to be a good person, how to be kind, the golden rule, things like that. Mm-hmm. And as long as you keep these two separate, there's no problem at all talking to New Age people. And so I think that when the problem occurs, however, when somebody from the natural sciences begins to pontificate about natural law, I mean about ethics, or when somebody from religion begins to pontificate about natural law, that's when we get into trouble. But as long as we keep these two separate, I don't see there's any conflict at all.
Hey, cool. Thank you so much, Dr. Michio Kaku, for talking to us this morning on 95BFM. I don't know how you're going to fit it all in just one evening, let alone a couple of hours on stage. You're playing Christchurch on Saturday. You're playing Auckland at the Victory Convention Centre on Wednesday the 31st of October, Michael Fowler Centre in Wellington on the 2nd of November, and the Isaac Theatre in Christchurch on the 3rd of November. It's going to be phenomenal to have you in the country. I'm really, really stoked you could give us so much of your time today. I hope you have a wonderful visit to New Zealand, and we look forward to the future of humanity as presented by Dr. Michio Kaku.
Great.
Thank
look
you so much.
To it.
Cheers. Thank you.